Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is World Form 10 Fighting Champion John Chung, and you're listening to the AMAA Legends and Pioneers Radio Blog Show with Professor Gary Lee and the Sport Karate Museum Archives, protecting the history, one warrior at a time. Enjoy.
Good evening, everyone. Aloha. Aloha to everyone who's listening tonight in your living room or your dojo or wherever you're at. This is Professor Gary Lee with the Sport Karate Museum, AMAA Masters Radio Network, with the show called Parts Unknown. I've got a really interesting show tonight. Lots of advertisement, lots of information. But always when we have a first responder, someone that has serviced our community through police work or firefighting or ambulance work, I get really excited because we get to talk about their profession along with how martial arts portrayed. And tonight's guest is dealing with that. And I'm just curious, is Mr. Summer, are you on the line right now?
I am, sir. How are you?
Well, good. I'm going to bring you on in just a few minutes. I'm wondering, is Mr. Piles on the line right now, too? Okay, we got to get Mr. Piles on there. Mr. Bowen,
yes, sir,
are you on
here.
The line? Oh, you are. Very good.
Yes, sir.
Well, hang loose, Wolverine. I'll bring you on, too. Well, good. Both my guests are on the show tonight. I've got special guest, Mr. Ted Summer, and the Wolverine. That's right, the Wolverine. National competitor, Mr. Dean Piles. And I'm going to be ringing them out in just a few minutes. But again, as I said, thank you for letting us come in your home tonight. This is our second year to be on this radio network, and we're so excited that we're around the world. We're actually in the homes of everybody that listens to us on Tuesday night, 6:30 in California, 7:30 in the Mountain Time, 8:30 where we're at here in Texas, of course, 9:30 on the East Coast. We got some people I want to shout out to. And first of all, to my first dear friend, Mr. Alex Reyes. Power, baby. That's right. The guy from Point Fighter Radio who covers all the major tournaments in the United States right now. He's got such a network up, but he really does the true coverage of martial art tournaments around the country. So if you'd like to follow what's going on around in America and all the tournament circuits, follow Point Fighter Radio, and that's my friend Alex Reyes, and that's power. Power, baby. That's right. We got some special things coming up also. Besides the information, I want you to know that every person that we interview here on the show is very special. And, next week we'll be at the Super Show. We'll be live at the Super Show doing the radio show. We'll be people around Benny Yakitas, Bill Wallace, all kinds of people, Jim Butcher, Jim Buten, Linda Dimley. And go on. So there's no telling who will be on the live radio show. But, we also got Mr. Mike Fillmore coming up, Mr. Johnny Thompson, Mr. Carmichael Simon. We got Golden Greek winner, six-time Golden Greek winner, Ashley Tyler, coming on this show. Interviews with people who are very special because I call them up and I ask them to share a little bit about their history. And speaking about history, the heart of our show is a book that was created in 1982 by gentlemen Dan Wallendorf and Dale Brooks. It was called The Who's Who in the Martial Arts. And it kind of disappeared for a while. And then a gentleman named Hansi Jesse Bowen, who's the producer of our show, brought it back to the light. And working with Mr. Joe Corey, Mr. Joe Smith, his lovely wife Gwen, lots of people behind the scenes, created the book back into the forelight. And the book tells a story of how America has built the martial arts into an industry, into a lifestyle for many of us. And what's really interesting, it's not really a who's who anymore. It just, we tell the stories of how you created your martial art history. And we honor you every year now, on this year, August 3rd, along with the Capital Classic, my dear friend Dennis Brown's tournament, in Washington, D.C., with an event that's going to have Dan Severin, the Beast from USC, Cynthia Rothrock, China O'Brien, the Queen of Movies, Mr. John Chung, some say the best traditional Korean kata performer in the world. a dear friend, Linda Denley, one of the greatest fighters that ever lived, and my author of the character credit for the Memoirs of American Samurai, Dana Abbott. This is August 3rd, 4th, and 5th in Washington, D.C. For more information, please contact Dr. Jesse Bowen on Facebook or Dennis Brown on Facebook or Damascus Circuit and find out more about the event August 3rd, 4th, and 5th. Well, tonight's guest is very special. As I said, he's a first responder, but on a different level, law enforcement. He was born in the 50s and began studying Kempo Karate under the Tracy brothers in November in 63. You know, he was awarded his black belt in 1968. You know, head instructor for the Tracy San Jose School and the Tracy Santa Clara School through the 70s. He opened his San Jose Kempo Karate Studio in 1988. He's an inductee into the International Kempo Hall of Fame in 2007. And by the way, he instigated and helped with a gentleman named Dr. Nick Chamberlain this past year put together the Kempo Hall of Fame for 2018. It was just an incredible event, and I was very honored to be part of that and to be inducted. He's elevated to judo, 10th degree black belt, June 29, 2013, after 50 years of Kempo. But, you know, everybody's got martial arts history, and it's incredible, but what's really unique about this gentleman, his law enforcement history. You know, he began his study as a sheriff working, you know, main jails in November of 1971. You know, he actually worked in San Jose Police June 1972 and assigned to undercover narcotics working high school schools in February 1975. We're going to talk a little bit about that. He remained undercover for 3.5 years. Now think about that. 3 years, no one knew who he was. Interesting. Assigned to homicide until 1978, and assigned to SWAT team in November 1978. I know he's an author. He just wrote a book about his life. We'll talk a little about that. I'm very honored to have Mr. Ted Summer as my special guest tonight. Ted, are you there, sir?
I am, sir.
And may I call you Ted?
Absolutely.
May I call you Ted, please? Thank you so much. And first of all, thank you for being on my show. I'm very honored, as I said earlier, to my listeners, to have any type of first responder, but to have someone in law enforcement. I'm very honored to have you here on the show. Thank you.
Well, I'm very greatly honored to be invited, sir.
Well, let's talk right off the bat. You started in the early years, I mean, under Mr. Tracy. What was it like being with the Tracy brothers in the early years?
Well, I started, they had opened their first school in 62 in San Francisco, and then they opened the second one in 63 in San Jose. I was only 14 years old, and and I know children are a big part of things now, but all anybody said then was, do we have to have this kid around? So, I was the kid, and, you know, nobody went easy on me. When I started competing in 66, they didn't have kids divisions, so I had to fight the adults. And, you know, you grow up fast. You learn.
Well, I'm going to take my listeners back a little bit. I remember the early years of Kempo. I got here in 69, but I remember the early years of 70, 71, and 72, and the early years of the Kempo CEOs, because most people were used to either Taekwondo, Ishinryu, Shotokan, Karate Do. And Kempo were different. We were black uniforms. We did movements that were really erratic, but it was very unique self-defense. But those guys, I remember, if I'm right, were very dangerous as a green belt, let alone brown belt or black belt. Kempo guys were really tough back then. I remember distinctly. And
we did have a reputation, yeah.
Yes, sir. And the Tracy's guys, they were known for doing two things I know of. One, they did personal self-defense, like personal lessons, but also they specialized in self-defense. I know that. So,
yeah, absolutely. The way that occurred was they brought in Tom Connor, who had been with the Arthur Murray Dance Schools, and he had been a student, and he suggested, you know, people could learn a lot faster and a lot more effectively with private instruction. It put
it changed the
responsibility.
The industry, though,
Pardon me?
It changed the industry to be able to teach private lessons other than group lessons because you made more money and you got better students, it seemed like. And to me,
absolutely. I mean, what it does is it puts the responsibility for learning on the student. In a group class, you can hide out, you can dog it, you know. But in a private lesson, the instructor is watching you every movement and correcting and making sure that you get it right, making sure that you don't take an imperfection and perfect an imperfection. The old saying is you only have to do something incorrectly three times and it becomes then your habit. So there's no question that changed the way martial arts was taught or had been taught for the previous two millennia.
Now, you opened your karate school before the narcotics thing that you did, the undercover work, or after?
No, it was after. I went undercover in 1975. They had a lot of pressure was being brought to bear on the chief, the mayor, the city council, because we had a real drug problem. Remember, the war on drugs began in 1974. And so what happened then is the Nixon administration put a lot of pressure on the pharmaceutical companies to stop overproducing. Up to that time, what we were arresting people for mostly were prescription pharmaceuticals that they weren't supposed to be possessing, Reds, which were Seconal, Christmas trees, which were stimulants, amphetamines, bifetamines, Black Beauties, things like that. Once that dried up, then you saw a lot of drugs like LSD, PCP, a lot more use of cocaine. Amphetamines were then being developed into methamphetamines. And so the whole drug scene changed. It was getting into the high schools, and they wanted to know who was bringing it in.
You didn't go inside the high school. You dealt with people outside. What exactly was your role play?
No, I went into the high school. I wasn't a student, but mixed in the parking lot and on the campus. Come to find out, because I could pass for 17 years old. That was my main qualification, was that I had been an English major in college. I wrote good reports. I was a black belt. They figured that minimized the danger because I would be working alone without cover. And the fact that I could pass for 17, they put me in what they call a deep cover situation there. But I soon
found
out.
Now, what do you mean by deep cover and undercover? What is the difference between deep cover and undercover?
Well, undercover is any time you use an officer in a role where he's pretending to be somebody else. Now, normally, the way narcotics were purchased by officers in those days was the officer would have a body transmitter on. He'd have what you call cover units. If anything went wrong, they could hopefully get in time to get him out of there. I worked completely alone. They didn't know where I was sometimes for days. I had a handler who I was supposed to report into at the end of each day, but sometimes I couldn't be done. And they just figured because it was high school, it would be minimal danger. But it turned out then that I was buying drugs from the same people that were supplying the criminal element in the city. I was buying from parolees, biker gangs, drug smugglers that were actually bringing it in from outside the country.
Wow, that sounds hairy, Ted. But I've got to ask you a question right from the parts unknown, because I got a couple emails today because people knew that I was going to interview you. It's like, what's the hairiest situation you got in when you had to use martial arts?
Well, there were a number.
Okay.
Used martial arts a lot because it's a tense situation, and you're dealing with not just people of unstable mental capacity, psychopaths, and that sort of thing, but then you throw in the drugs on top of that, and you've got a real distorted reality. I mean, the closest I came, I'll give you an example. I went in with this what we'd call an unwitting informant. He didn't know I was an undercover officer, and he was taking me to the guy who was his connection, rang the doorbell. The guy opened the door. We went in. The guy comes around with a gun right at my forehead and says, I told you not to bring anybody here, to the other guy. And he says, I had to kill both of you. And his eyes were red and bloodshot, and he was obviously under the influence. And so I went ahead and made a move. I didn't know if he was going to accidentally discharge the thing, but I just didn't want to get shot in the head. But simple technique, you drop, come up, take the barrel in both hands, and bend it back and disarmed him. Easy enough. I mean, not difficult. Then
I got to ask you, brother Ted. I got to ask you, because you are a brother. You know, I've got quite a few friends that are involved with homicide and work their way up. Everyone has a different feeling toward it. That moment that you realize that gun's at your head, what do you think besides the martial art reaction? I mean, what comes in your mind? All the training. I mean, what exactly goes through the mind of a professional?
Yeah, the training, it's really interesting, because once you decide you're going to go ahead and defend, the training just kicks in. It's just, it's smooth, and you're usually, what's happened is I'm standing there afterwards going, well, that was easy. It's just the years of training and everything just take over.
So how easy was it to get out of that position of being an undercover agent and get back your life?
Well, at the end of it, I was at the point where I said, you know, get me out of here, because I'm going to go insane, or I'm going to actually become a psychopath myself. And they took me out.
You became an author and a producer instead. Good job.
Well, they cleaned me up, and then they put me into homicide to investigate the deaths by overdose. We had a lot of situations where people were using drug overdose to eliminate a rival in the drug world. But that only lasted about 6 months, because they found out that nobody really cared about drug dealers being overdosed by other drug dealers. So I went back to uniform for a few months, and then they pulled me into the SWAT team. Greatest job I ever had, by the way.
Why you say SWAT was the greatest job you had? Tell me why.
Well, at the time that I went into the SWAT team, I was still in my 20s.
Okay.
I was in tip-top shape. I was a second degree. I got my third degree the very next year. And we got a chance to do everything that you want to do. We were police officers, but we were deployed in two-man unmarked cars. If there was an operation that we had to handle, we would converge to one point, dress out, and deploy. But otherwise, we worked without what you call beat responsibility. We could do follow-up for the detectives. We could initiate our own cases. We could do search warrants. We could do what you call crimes of opportunity, in progress crime, all kinds of stuff, predatory law enforcement. Go out and
you know,
find it as it's
really
happening.
Cool. I've interviewed, like I said, quite a few police officers, and particularly one of my dear friends, Mr. Roy Kerbin, who now is Judge Roy Kerbin. He works for Mr. Wayburn in the Fort Worth administration now. He runs the administration for Mr. Wayburn. And I asked him one time, I said, Mr. Kerbin, what's the difference between a homicide detective and say the rookie on the street? And you know what he told me? He said absolutely nothing, Gary. And he explained it to me. He said, just the experience, of course, but a police officer is a police officer. And that's something that really has stuck with me for all these years. And I really admire your work and what you've done for us to be able to protect this.
Well, he's absolutely correct. I mean, when I was undercover in narcotics, that job would have been much better done by an actor, but the problem is the chain of evidence and then the credibility of the witness. So if we're using somebody who's a drug user and he's handled the evidence before we get our hands on it, it's tainted. So a much better case is a direct sale to a police officer, plus the intelligence they were getting back, because they built an incredible intelligence file just on the people that I had contact with. There were people on the FBI's 10 most wanted list that I was in contact with. Bill Ayers, when he was on the run. I mean, just, it was... Bill Ayers was part of the Weatherman Underground back in the 70s.
Okay.
They were the first homegrown terrorist group. They advocated the overthrow of the United States government by force.
Wow, that sounds really, really incredible. Well, you know what? I had the pleasure of meeting you a few years back at Last Man Standing, where our dear friend Dr. Nick Chamberlain put together an event that was just super, super incredible. But I met you because you had the same thing. We had something together. You're an author and I'm an author, and you sat right across from me, and you were selling your book. So I want to talk about your book a little bit. What inspired you to write your book, and what does it entail exactly in your vision of it?
Well, you know, I never intended to write a book. I always used things that happened to me in teaching the martial arts to establish the validity of what I was about to teach. If it had worked in a real-life situation, that gives it some validity with the student. And people had told me, I read a book. And I said, nobody wants to read this stuff. And the other thing is, police officers don't like other police officers who write books, because the book usually is about how honest they are and how everybody else is, all the other police officers are corrupt, like what Serpico wrote. But I was teaching at Jeff Speakman's event in Las Vegas one year, and Mills Crenshaw, who was one of Ed Parker's first students at BYU when he came over in 1956. He was a published author, and he heard it, and he said, well, you got to write a book. I'll help you. And I said, no, I don't want to write a book. And he said, well, tell me, just talk to me, and I'll write it. He was going to ghostwrite it. Well, he wrote about two chapters, and the problem was, having never been a police officer, it didn't sound right. It sounded like a scared civilian who was thinking, how the heck did I get into this? So I took it over and started writing it myself. As I said, I was a history English major in college, and Crenshaw was impressed with my writing, and he said, well, I'll edit it for you, and stayed on the project with me. And that's how we brought it about. There it is.
I mean, what have you done as far as marketing, as far as getting around the country or the world? Who's helped you do that?
Well, we did. We had a website set up. Mills was handling that, and then he died, abruptly. I've done a lot of radio interviews, book signings. Did a number of talks for not for LEAP, but in regards to their agenda about the war on drugs. With Rotary clubs and Lions clubs and things like that, and then I've always, promoted it at any of the martial arts events. I teach at a number of events each year.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm gonna put you on the spot here, Ted. I'm gonna ask you to give a number where they can actually contact you, and if you'd be so kind to maybe. Let's say the 10th person that calls you, would you give them a book, autograph it for the
Spokane? Oh, yeah, book? Absolutely.
So let's do that. Yeah. Let's do that. For all the listeners who are listening or maybe listen after the podcast, if you call the number that I'm going to ask Mr. Summer to give, and you're the 10th caller, and you have to keep count of it, he's going to give you a free book, and he'll autograph it for you personally, and that'll be from the Spokane Museum. Because, I put him on the spot because he was – that same year, the Last Man Standing, we put him in as a history general. And that goes in my second subject, is that last year you helped put together the Kempo Hall of Fame. And that was pretty incredible. I'm still overwhelmed about how successful that event was. How much work was that put together?
Well, I got to defer to Nick Chamberlain and his crew. They were incredible.
Absolutely.
He really put on a first-class event. I mean, I did some of the legwork and a lot of the planning. I mean, we collaborated on the Hall of Fame coins and you know, how some of the programs were going to be run, and then,
so,
of course,
let me say,
you know,
one more thing. Let's say something about Nick Chamberlain, Dr. Nick Chamberlain. He's a Kempo Styles, he trained under Nick Sirio and Nancy Sirio, and incredible history he has. And he has a school in Dallas, and the old Vince Tamura Judo School. If you know that name, Vince Tamura, is the old Judo School. Mr. Chamberlain runs that school. But I want to say something. His staff, as you said earlier, and his lovely wife Kimberly, and himself personally, I've never been treated. I want to say this. I want to say this publicly. In all the events I've gone to, and everybody treats me very well, but I've never been treated like I've been treated at that event. But as you said, this staff is incredible.
In all fairness, a lot of people have said the same thing, Gary. They made everybody feel pretty special. And by the way,
I thought I was home. I felt I could walk outside. I'd see the beach. I was in Hawaii. Honestly, I was very great. I did.
Well,
I did. Yeah.
He is also having another event this year, July 13th, 14th, 15th in Dallas, called the Keepers of the Flame. And that will be a good event. I'll be teaching there. I'll be teaching a two-hour seminar. The first hour will be on the healing arts, which I'll give you a kind of a lead into it. The way the healing arts work is we go into a nerve center, we apply pressure and deprive the muscle of nervous stimulation, which causes it to relax. And then we're able to work the tightness, the knots, the spasming out of it. Then we take that into the martial arts, and when you strike that same nerve center, the muscle fails. And you either paralyze, you can break a hold, you can knock them out. So the second hour will be on the martial applications of those same nerve manipulations. And I'll be doing that on Saturday.
I got to ask you, because you hit a subject that I've always thought was very interesting, because I knew Mr. Gilman back in the day when he was a USKA champion, and back when he was training Muhammad Ali, and then when he traveled with Rennie Press and my uncle Wally J. But Mr. Gilman developed what they call the chi ball. Is that almost on the same level as a nerve? How similar is what you're telling? I mean, you have to physically touch somebody to do what you're doing, right?
Well, you transfer chi, you block chi, you reverse chi, but no,
but
you
have
got,
to
learn how to throw chi.
You have to make actual contact.
I've never learned how to throw chi.
Okay. Do you believe in that?
Well, no, not particularly, but I do. No. I've seen Dillman work, and he's got some good stuff. As far as the no touch knockout, I don't.
How do you explain the T-ball? I'm just curious because you're someone of knowledge, and I don't have no idea about it.
Well,
so I'm just asking as a very ignorant white man.
The human body is a very low voltage electrical electrochemical machine. You actually have a flow of current in your body. You can enhance that. You can block it. You can even reverse it if you're skilled enough. But as far as causing a what you would call like a gap where it would actually jump to something else, no, I don't.
Yeah,
I mean,
let me share a story with you. And I know it's your show, but I got to share this story with you. There's a man who passed away. God bless him. His name is Victor Chen. He was the first kung fu instructor here in Houston, taught at the University of Houston, Texas. And I hung out with him in his shop in the early, early 80s and late 70s. And I saw a guy come into the shop one day who was really smarting off, and he said he was a black belt. But he was touching everything, and then he touched his sword. And then I remember he touched the blade. And it bothered me a little bit, but then he touched the Chinese sword, and he touched the blade, and that kind of made Victor feel upset a little bit. So Victor called him over, and he introduced himself, and he shook his hand. And he shook his hand. He took his other hand, and he touched the bottom of his thumb, Ted, and that guy dropped to the floor. He dropped mm-hmm. his bullet then. And he dropped, and afterwards he told me, he said it was like an electric shock that shot up his arm to his brain and said, go down, do whatever this guy says. And he was in pain until Victor touched him again on the other side of his hand, and it went away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can't explain that, but I was there. I saw that. And
right.
that was contact. But as
yes,
as not
yeah, I had to make contact.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, that's interesting. You teach that. That's cool. Wow. So how would I get in touch with Nick and come to that Keeper of the Flame?
Well, if you go to his website, www.dallaskempo.com, under events, there's a sign-up sheet. I'll tell you what, I know he had early sign-up that's already expired, but if anybody calls and says they heard about it on the show, I'll call Nick and tell him to give you the early sign-up price.
Wow, cool. Say that again for all my listeners that will be listening. When's the date again? July what?
13th, 14th, 15th. It's Friday, Saturday,
got
Sunday.
Time. We got off that. Say that again, what you just said, please.
July 13th, 14th, 15th. Friday the 13th, Saturday the 14th, Sunday the 15th.
Tell them about they get a discount if they say something to the show. I like that. About that part.
All they got to do is mention their show, and they get they'll get the early bird discount.
Cool. And tell how to get your book. I want 10 calls to call in. How do they get your book?
There's a couple ways to get my book. Well, first of all, for the free book, to be the 10th caller, as soon as we go off the air, call 408-645-4675. And I will tell you, you're either 1, 2, 3, 4, or you're the winner. To order the book, you can just email me at T, as in Ted, L, my middle name Leslie, S, Sumner, TLS 1580, that was my badge number, at yahoo.com. The book's $19.95, $4 shipping, so $24.
Well, cool. I appreciate that. Well, listen, hang on the air. Don't go nowhere. We're going to come back and we're going to play the Legends name game. And as I said in the pre-interview, that's where I hit you with a couple names, a couple surprises, and you get to talk about them for 2 to 3 minutes and how they influence your life. All right, Ted?
Okay. Sounds great to me.
Well, thank you, buddy. Hey, we're sitting and talking to Mr. Ted Sumner, law enforcement, retired police officer, SWAT team member and author, and Kempo Black Belt. And we'll come back and we'll play the Legends name with him. Legend's name game with him. Right now, I'd like to take a small break and talk about something that I'm really excited about. I've got a new segment that I'm bringing on, along with the present segment I've been doing, which is called the Willie Hicks. I don't get it. I don't understand. And I've combined it now with someone very special in my life. It's one of my students. He's known as the Wolverine. And He's a character. He's not only one of the top competitors in the national karate circuit in weapons and divisionals and traditional kata and musical forms too, but he also speaks what he says and means what he says. And we're going to bring him on here in just a minute. We're going to talk about something. In fact, I'll bring him on right now. Hey, Wolverine, Dean Piles.
Yes, sir.
There?
Yes, sir.
Goodness gracious. How you doing, Wolverine? How you doing?
Doing great, sir. Doing great.
Good, good. Well, you know, I had to brag about you a little bit. I know that you just recently won some divisions at the Battle of Atlanta, and you're also rated in the NASCAR tournament circuit. Tell me a little bit about that.
Right now, after the Battle of Atlanta, I'm ranked number one in 3 divisions, and as you can see at the Battle of Atlanta, those divisions are – hat. So you got to be on your A game at all times. So,
that brings up my subject tonight. Hey, listen. That brings up my subject. I wanted my listeners to know that I'm just not talking to someone that wants to complain or not be negative, or I mean, be negative, because you're not negative. And we're not about being negative. We won't be positive in anything we say. If something happened at the Battle of Atlanta that we both witnessed this weekend that bothered you and I both. And we're going to talk a little bit about it right now. And that was where a judge came up to a underbelt and said that he or she wasn't quality enough to be a part of that tournament circuit. Tell me how you feel about that and how that came about.
Well, you know, I had heard this. This has not happened just at the Battle of Atlanta. This has happened several times. And, you know, my whole take on it is if you want the martial arts to grow, the judges, okay, they're not always going to throw scores that are going to make people happy. But, however, if they are scoring according to the rules and the criteria of that division, then it doesn't matter. You know, and they can give constructive criticism. Hey, you need more power. You need more speed. Say if it's a creative division, hey, you need more creativity. You need more level of difficulty. You know, if it's musical, you need to be on the beat. You know, traditional, you need more execution of technique. Your power needs to be up, your speed, your intensity, your presentation. But you don't ever, as a judge, when a competitor is, especially if a competitor is competing and they're really wanting to do good, and they maybe not win, but they don't come up and they don't badger the judge. They just come up and say, "Sir, what did you see in my routine that I need to work on?" I do that myself sometimes, just to see what they say, to see if they're going by the criteria of the rules, or if they're just going to wing something at me because they was looking at some chick walking down the aisle or looking at some dude or playing on their cell phone, you know, because sometimes that happens. So when you look at a child and you say to a child, well, you're just not cut out to be NASCAR material, it's really bothersome because not only could that child be so hurt by that, instead of giving them constructive criticism that they quit martial arts altogether, they may just say, I don't ever want to go to competition. Not only that, other kids that hear that, they may also get disheartened. So, yeah, it's one thing to be a judge, but it doesn't make you better than anybody on that floor. The person that is willing to get out there on the floor weekend after weekend and take those hits, that criticism, the scores, whether it be good or bad, that person deserves a lot of respect. And to look at any competitor and say, you're not cut out to be that, you don't have no idea. Because this same kid, and I'm not going to mention any names, I have witnessed at other NASCAR competitions blister the people that are supposedly the cream of the crop.
Well, Dean, let me stop you right there. I don't want to pick on NASCAR, okay?
No, it's not NASCAR. Listen to me.
It just happened to be at a NASCAR event. I know this happens at, around the country on different circuits because there's black belts that feel that they're in a position to tell that competitor that they're not really qualified to be part of that particular circuit. I understand that, and I can understand that type of criticism. But what bothers me is that you don't tell a child that's an underbelt, that hasn't got the maturity yet of an advanced belt, but a child, and you tell that person that he's worked hard just to maybe just do that 20-movement form, to have enough courage to get out there and do it in front of the crowd, in front of her parents, in front of people she don't know, and then to break her spirit down to say that, that just drives me crazy. Now, how do we change that? This is how we change it.
Well,
we make sure that the judges are qualified that work with young people. I want to put people there. And I say, well, that's a hassle. We haven't got time for that. We got to just put judges there because they're coming in. We don't have enough. Well, see, you make time. Because what I saw at this particular tournament, it bothered me enough that I made a part of it on my show to bring you on. So I want it changed. It needs to be changed. That's what we have to do.
And with that being said, you know, I agree with the judge that the NASCAR circuit is the cream of the crop. I mean, when you're competing in NASCAR, you got to be bringing your A game. That's where the big boys are at. That's where the hard hitters are at. But you don't know 2 years down the road, a year down the road, that the suckiest competitor on that floor, because maybe they just don't have the time in or the training in yet, may end up being the most all-star competitor that they've had in years. I mean, it can happen easy. So you want
to
cultivate.
I'm a firm believer of the Cinderella story, so that's cool. Well, listen, Dean, thank you so much. But remember, you got to come up with subjects that my listeners want to talk about. And remember also, wait a minute, you're too nice. I thought you were going to scream at me.
I was trying not to scream, but because it wasn't at you, so I will close with it. This is my closing thing.
You can scream at me and say, I don't mind.
Yeah, if I
see or hear.
Yes. Yes.
Go ahead, scream.
Okay. If see or hear somebody that's been put in the place that cultivates our youth in the martial arts, criticize a competitor in that way, because it's not only going to make the competitor quit and take money from their coach, it's also going to make them quit and take money from the competition and from the circuit, and it lessens us as a group. If I hear that,
Dean, that's right there. I think that gets the point across, sir. So you can't. I don't want you to say something that you regret. But listen, I'll save you for next week. Next week, I'll have the Wolverine on and say, end it with what you say. So, you say something really cool. You say a phrase. I say what I mean what I say. Say that.
I say what I mean, and I mean what I say, and I'm going to say what needs to be said. And it's going to step on some toes, but it's going to get people looking in the right direction, and it's going to make change for the better, because I love martial arts, and I want that sport to continue to grow, because martial artists, sport karate martial artists, should be just as highlighted as football players, baseball players, basketball players, or anybody, because they work twice as hard.
I love you, man. God bless you. Thanks for being here. That was Kicking with the Wolverine. God bless you. We'll be with you next week. Hey, listen. Bye-bye, buddy. Hey, listen, I want to mention a couple of other things. Right now, I just got a call from Mr. Bowen. If you call in right now and you talk to Master Bowen, 919-618-8075, he will not only give you a free T-shirt if you ordered the book, the new Legends of Martial Arts Masters book, that's pretty incredible. He'll give a T-shirt for everyone that calls within the show or listens to the podcast. Again, 919-618-8075. Get one of those cool T-shirts. They're pretty cool. Hey, remember also that coming up right around the corner in July will be the Aloha Open. And for more information, contact Lee Adonio, and that's on Facebook. And the Aloha Open is one of the tournaments, the five-star rated event from the Sport Karate Museum. And, of course, September the 28th and 29th will be the Sport Karate Museum's Mikey Row More Roast, along with Kata Wars, Bubba Kumite, and the Jim Harrison's America's Challenge. We're going to probably talk about in depth that next week at the Las Vegas Super Show, so stay tuned for that. We'll be in detail about what's going on there, on the cool things that are going on. But one more plug before I bring on my special guest. I'm very honored that a gentleman named Rocky DiRico, one of the top forms and competitors on the national circuit, has adopted the Sport Karate Museum. He was one of the founding members of the John Paul Mitchell team, and he was coached by Mr. Don Rodriguez and Christine and Ben Rodriguez and Damon Gilbert. Rocky DiRico is an amazing guy. Still teaches Kempo Karate up in the Northeast area, and he has asked the Sport Karate Museum to be involved with something that he created a few years back, and it's the Rocky DiRico's International Black Belt Hall of Fame. And it was very elite. He didn't want to put mass people in. He wanted to just handpick a handful of people every year. And when he called me, I said, I'm very honored, but, you know, that's not what I'm focused about. I appreciate the nomination. And then he just really was persistent. And I said, well, this is what I'd like to do then. I'll be involved if you allow me to nominate 8 to 10 people a year through the Sport Karate Museum. So for the past 3 years, I've had the honor to honor people like Jim Harrison, Mr. Norris, Mr. Bertelson, of course, Jim Buten, Charlotte Emerson, Doug Emerson, Mikey Romore, Daryl Stewart. I can go on. It's just been incredible. So every year we put in there just a few people, and this year I'm very honored to induct, nominate, and share with them September the 29th at the banquet, Mr. Jimmy Fighting Irish Anderson, Mr. Neil Harden, Miss Tammy Whalen, Miss Darlene McPherson-Pagels, Miss Karen Slatcher, Mr. Ricky K. Smith, Mr. Randy L. Smith, Mr. Danny McCall, Mr. Carl Napovitz, and the first lady motorcycle officer in America, Miss Joanna Needham. Please congratulate these fine ladies and gentlemen to be inducted into the Rocky DiRico's International Bob Hall of Fame September the 29th at the Living Legends Celebrity Roast. Hey, Mr. Ted Summer.
Yes.
There, sir.
I am.
Well, I appreciate you staying and listening to me jabber away and trying to pay some sponsors. But we're back now playing the Legends name game. This is something I created a few years back, and it's something pretty cool. I hit you with a name, and you talk about them for 3 minutes or you know, and if I get my 2 cents, I throw my 2 cents in if I know them. Or I know his story. So here we go. The first one I'm going to throw at you is Mr. Al Tracy.
Oh, well, I mean, he was my instructor. He's the one who, he taught me my introductory lessons, and then his brother Jim was my primary instructor after that until I got my black belt, and then I moved over into the instructor training with Al. The man was a visionary. He was a genius. He took the system, he organized it, codified it, made it like college courses. You take the course, you take a test, you get the belt and the diploma. I mean, it's simple as that. If you don't pass, well, you go back through the course again. He gave me my first job. When all my buddies were working at gas stations and mowing lawns, I was teaching martial arts, you know. I mean, that was pretty big stuff. At the time, when I started, he was paying me $1.80 an hour. That meant I got 90 cents for every half hour private lesson I taught. Doesn't sound like much.
Hour. I remember those days. I remember $1.65 an hour days.
Yeah, but at that time, the minimum wage was $1.45, so I was doing better than my buddies, you know.
Hey, I got a great Al Tracy story. At Last Man Standing, Mark came up to me, his son. And he said, Mr. Tracy would like to speak to you. So I went over there, and it was so cool. He gave me the ring, the Kempo ring, the one with the dragon tiger and the silver ring. And he appreciated the work that I've been doing. And what people don't realize, you do, because I sent it to you, I made Shishi Don under Mr. Tracy. He promoted me to Shishi Don, my 7th degree black belt back in the day. And, golly, John Chung and John Privat, a lot of people, Ed Daniel, it was pretty cool. So you mentioned Jim Tracy earlier, and that was his brother. Now, did you train with Jim Tracy, actually train and fight him and work with him?
Oh, yeah, and everything, yeah, I mean, he taught me the art.
What was his karate like then? Tell me about it.
Well, he was smaller, younger than his brother, so his art had to be perfect. His form was impeccable. His timing was amazing. He taught me control. And I can't tell you how many times that either got me out of something or enabled me to finish the guy off without hurting him too bad. But he was a heck of an instructor. Like I say, because he had to really rely on the effectiveness of the art. Therefore, his form had to be just absolutely perfect. One story, we were at the old San Jose school, which was actually just across the border in Santa Clara, one block into Santa Clara, but they called it the San Jose school. And it was a hot day, Ralph Castellanos and his brother Benny and Jim Trevino are sitting on the mat, and Al is teaching Richard Lee, and I was getting a lesson from Jim Tracy, and he was standing with his back to the door, just had on a pair of gi pants and a T-shirt. A guy walked in, he looked around, and he said, "I can kick anybody's ass in this place." And Jim, just with his peripheral vision, looked up, boom, caught him in the throat just enough with a sword hand, just enough that he collapsed down, crawled out, and threw up out in the gutter, and then went away.
That's funny.
But in those days, you used to get a lot of that. You know, people didn't understand the martial arts, and they stupidly walked in and would challenge people.
Oh, absolutely. Tell me about another gentleman named Tom Connor.
Well, Tom Connor was, first of all, the guy was a bodybuilder, you know, par excellence. The man had, you know, movie star good looks. He'd walk down the street, women would turn and look at him and whistle. But he started with Arthur Murray's. He learned their whole business system. And as a dance instructor, the man had just incredible timing and understood the importance of form. And he transferred that into his martial arts. And he brought, order such as it was into the whole system with the private lessons, the method with which we taught the private lessons, the whole business system. In addition to that, I learned several of the katas from him, and he was just absolutely incredible. I mean, moved like a dancer.
So my listeners understand, when karate was first come to America, you know, most people who did karate, who taught it, weren't business people. And, of course, you mentioned Arthur Murray's. Arthur Murray's had done the industry in dancing, and they specialized in private debt, private lessons, and also contracts. So then, of course, martial arts was involved with the gyms and the fitness centers. And they took that information from Arthur Murray's and the fitness centers, and this is how the business became the business it is today. It's amazing how it all started, and you were a pioneer in that, I know, because I was too, to be able to sell $19.99 intros, to be able to sell them a contract for so-and-so. I mean, Mr. Minshew and Butler Academy taught me the art of the deal or the art of the sale. But, you know, it was amazing times because at that time I was being paid on commission. I loved it, you know. It was incredible. Plus, I got to teach free. So, to me, I was in heaven. So,
yeah. Another important thing, not to be overlooked, is you've got to remember that we were just one generation into the martial arts being taught in English. Those guys in Hawaii that brought it to the mainland, they learned in the native language of the instructor and had to work it out. And so they learned a lot by watching. They couldn't get detailed explanation. And that's what Tom Connor and the Tracys brought into the instructional schema. We were able to verbally articulate down to the most minute details precisely what you were doing. And when you can get that and then articulate it back yourself, then you really understand what it is you've learned. It was a whole new way of presenting the martial arts.
Yes, it was. It changed. Now, the next person I'd like to bring up is someone that was very close to my heart. We are now, well, no, Paul does it. I think the Bill Wallace and the Joe Lewis systems up north, they do it. But we did it when he passed away a few years back. Honor Mr. Lewis every year with the Joe Lewis Memorial Fighting Dragon Image Award. You won't be missing Joe Lewis. You have a relationship with him?
Well, certainly. He, you know, was he came on with Tracy's in the early 70s. It may have even been the late 60s. But he, you know, at that time, we didn't, you know, Kempo didn't have
early 70s.
A competitive format. So we brought Joe in to teach it because we were getting disqualified all the time. And we were pissing people off because we were using technique that wasn't considered, you know, to be part of the whole fighting methods there. So Joe came in and he organized it and taught us how to compete and how to win. And then he, you know, developed the checkered gi. And I was there when he got the he had the first checkered
illusions. It was made for illusions. The illusions.
Yeah, absolutely. He explained the whole thing, the white, the black, why the pattern was the way it was.
The guys hated it. I'm telling you right off the bat, they hated it. That's why Roger and Mr. Lewis wore. They hated it. The guys that fought those guys, they hated it. The interviews I've done, they didn't like the illusion of Ghee. Now, I've got a pretty decent Mr. Lewis story that deals with Tracy's. He was fighting, and he was fighting a Korean guy, and he busted him up, his nose, pretty bad. And the USK guys came over, and he said, listen, Tria says, he'll put you in the USK, and he wants you in the USK. Of course, Mr. Lewis never joined the USK. And he told me this story. He said that he didn't join, but he told Trius and the guys, Mr. Shelton and those guys, he said, look, I'll join the USK if you don't disqualify me. And they didn't disqualify him. And, of course, he beat the crap out of this Korean guy. And, of course, afterwards, they all thought he was going to join the USK. Of course, he didn't. And the rest of the story is told. But I think that's pretty cool. But people don't realize that Mr. Lewis had heart, too. He had tremendous heart, very knowledgeable, very smart. And those Tracy years was very formidable. It was very cool. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
How about Ralph Castellanos?
Ralph Castellanos, he won the world championship one year. He was one of our original black belts. He used to drive this old Buick 442, and when I was 15, he and his brother just finished working out. They threw me $20 in the keys and said, go pick us up some hamburgers. I said, I don't have a license. He said, neither do I. So I got in that thing. I could barely see over the dashboard and drove down to McDonald's and got him some burgers. But Ralph was the one who he pulled me aside when I was about – I just caught my growth. I was about 17, 16, almost 17. And he told me, look, you're never going to be any faster than these guys.
Right.
And I said, so what do I do? He said, well, you're much quicker. And I said, okay, what are you talking about? I'm not any faster, but I'm quicker. He said, well, think of it this way. You know, you can go 100 miles an hour. Well, you can get there in half the time they can. So I said, what do you mean? What do I do? He says, you got to quit trying to fight from the outside. You got to move in. Move inside where your speed makes a difference, your quickness makes a difference. And that's when I changed my whole fighting technique to move in, jam close, take it away from them, make them readjust, and then, as Joe Lewis taught, make them fight on your count. There's very much a beat to the fight, and you gotta make a fight
that's
on your
knowledge.
Throw them off.
Absolutely, that's good knowledge there. Absolutely. Well, you know, the next person is very close to me. I got to go to the battle a couple weeks ago or last weekend, and John the Tibbet Hat, another Hawaiian. We got to dedicate our awards, the Joe Lewis Returner Awards, to all the Hawaiians who didn't make it to the mainland. Well, the main person from Hawaii that most people know about who came from the mainland with Koshu Kenpo Karate was Mr. Ed Parker, who formed American Kenpo Karate. Now, that's the person next to talk about, Mr. Ed Parker. How did he influence you?
Well, he, you know, was Al Tracy and Jim Tracy's instructors. And, I mean,
yes.
I don't remember.
Right there, Ted, before you go further, let me say this to you personally. To all my Kenpo friends out there who are listening, and I know many of you are, to me, this is the healing process. There's no difference between Kenpo, Kaji Kenpo. Yeah, there's maybe different katas and different wazas, but we're all Hawaiian family. And to have someone who is under the Tracy organization all these years, who literally worked and lived under Tracy's organization, and then talk about Ed Parker, I admire that to you, Ted, deeply, because I understand that there is there's always been a difference. And how did Ed Parker influence you? I'm just curious.
Well, the difference really is more amongst the students and the whole business thing, because in business they were competitors. But, you know, I never got through a lesson where Jim Tracy didn't reference Ed Parker at some point or another.
Amen.
The Tracys greatly admired Ed Parker, and they were, you know, disappointed when the students would attack them,
yes.
But he had a very, very great influence on them, and he used to come up. I mean, we were one big happy family for a while. He would come up once a month. He'd do the Saturday class. I'd always be there. And then for one of our promotion banquets, he spent all Saturday afternoon teaching my training partner and me the two-man set and then some demo techniques so that we could be in the demonstration with him that night.
Wow.
And so I got to work with
him. What was it like training with the master? What was it like training with Edmund Parker, the father of American Kempo? How cool was that?
Well, you don't dare get it wrong. Once he tells you something, you make sure that you do it just the way he said. You don't want to make him have to tell you twice, because if you do, he's going to show you the next time, and he's going to show you on you, and it's going to hurt. So you try to do it right.
You know what I love about him? I love the fact that he had a microphone in one hand, and he'd be hitting you with all these different techniques and wazzes and bam, 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 doing like the dance, that dance to death, and switching the microphone. It was magic. And his memory, I understand his memory was just so perfect. He could remember people in seminars, tournaments, everything. It was incredible. Wow.
Well,
I got to know him.
Working with him, you know, hands-on, like that. I mean, he believed in contact, and he believed that that was a really, really good instructor. And Al Tracy learned that from him. In the instructor's classes, Al always used me as his dummy because I was about his size. You know, we were the same height and everything. But Ted Parker was a big man, and when he made contact with you, you felt it. And yet, his control was absolutely impeccable, because after, I remember that session, I took my gi off, and I had all these little red implosions on the skin, but
really?
No bruising,
just
the little red marks where he'd burst the blood vessels, you know.
Yeah,
it was incredible. It was it's something I really, really remember. He had a very, very, very strong effect on me there.
Well, rest in peace, Mr. Parker. We love talking about you. Now, this next gentleman is my all-time favorite guy. He went to my first Living Legends. I've got a great story about him. I'll obviously talk about him first. You know, I know he's been in the hospital. Karen, I talked to her just a few days ago, and we're talking about the great fighting legend, Roger Green. How's he influenced you? And I'll tell you my story after you tell me.
Well, I met Roger. You know, Roger and a few other guys, they were students of Bob Babich in Kangdawan, Korean style. And Babich was a tough instructor. I mean, these guys knew their stuff. But they all worked up at United Technologies. They were working on the fuel for the Apollo 11, the Saturn V that was going to take Apollo 11 to the moon. They had a big explosion up there, and a bunch of guys got killed. And Roger and his buddies came in the next day and said, you know, told Al Tracy, we understand that, you know, we can possibly make a living teaching the martial arts, and we're ready for a career change. So we fast-tracked them. They came in every day. They trained every day to learn our system. They were already black belts. I mean, they had good stuff. They just had to learn our system as well as the business end of it. And so being one of the senior black belts, I know at 19 years old it sounds strange to be the senior black belt, but we had so many schools opening across the country that guys would make first black and they were gone. They'd open schools. And I was, you know, I had to stay in college because I was going to be drafted if I didn't. So consequently, over a period of time, I just became the senior guy. And so I would work with him. Ted Mancuso would work with him. Tom Bursick, Bill Yeh, all really great martial artists. But at the end of the evening, they always wanted to spar, you know. And so we'd stay and fight. Well, with Roger, you didn't just say, hey, that was a good training session. It was, I won, didn't I? No, Roger, we were just training. Oh, I won. Then we're going to keep fighting. We'd go until finally I'd just say, Roger, you won, man. That was the only way I could end the training session.
You know, the losing gi, I've got his gi and his black belt that he donated to the museum. It still has blood on the sleeve and the shoulder. And he didn't wash it deliberately because he wanted to give it to me with the blood on it. Now, my best Roger Green story, this is a good one. The first Living Legends, 1999. Now, he's been to a couple. But the first one, it was a big deal. You know, all the legends were there. It was the first one. They introduced what I'm doing, museum and everything. I had this guy at the door who was a kung fu guy. That was the first mistake. No offense against kung fu, but they didn't have the etiquette that a karate guy did. And so he's at the front door, and Karen and Roger go to the door, and the guy was really a smart aleck to him, to Mr. Green. And Mr. Green got me to the corner and said, "Gary, get over here." I said, "Yes, sir." He says, "If you don't move that guy up from the front door, I'm going to take him outside, and I'm going to teach you manners." And I knew exactly what he was going to do. He was going to jap slap him and take him outside and beat the crap out of him. And so I got rid of that guy, and Mr. Green was very happy with me. And through the years, we've become very, very close. Now, I'm honoring Joe Lewis right after he passed away, and I get permission from Jeff Smith, who comes and speaks. Mr. Corley sends the video. I've gone through the right channels to honor Mr. Lewis. Give up the award. Everyone knows about it. Well, I get a call from this Paul, the guy who runs the Joe Lewis Fighting Sisters now. He didn't know me from a hill of beans. And he didn't enjoy me doing this. Of course, I'd gone through the channels and gotten permission. And then he gets a call from Roger Green. Roger tells him exactly who I am, what I do, what I've done, what I'm doing. And, of course, Paul calls and apologizes, and we're friends, rich and deep friends now. Roger Green has taken care of me through the years. Dad, he really has. He's a good guy. I love him and care deeply. Yeah.
The guy's the salt of the earth. I mean,
hear about Jim Stewart.
Well, Jim Stewart and Roger were best friends growing up.
Okay.
They played high school football. Jim was the center. Roger was the quarterback. And
okay.
They both studied at Babbage's school, and they both came and learned at the same time our business system and our system. Roger went to Tulsa. Jim went to Indianapolis and then ultimately to Louisville, then came back years later, went to law school, and had a dojo in Los Angeles. He was the same mold as Roger. I mean, he was tough. Both of them, they hit. I mean, well, Roger took the reverse punch to a new level. I mean, he made it a science and a weapon of mass destruction. I mean, it and Jim
like
right
that.
Along with him. I mean, they
like that. Yeah,
those like guys that. Both hit hard. Well, Jim now is he's a federal judge in Tulsa.
Wow.
He was a chemist working up there with Roger at the same place. Roger was a physicist, and he had his school in Louisville. Turned out some great, great students: Henry Childers and Roger Lee, and among others, Gary Avery. And you know, again, he's a less well-known version of Roger. So,
wow, cool.
Tell me about this last guy
who I've heard so many stories about. I heard he was very dangerous, and that's Professor Sid Cutler.
Oh, he was, you know, Henry Okazaki's top student in Hawaii.
Yes.
He was out of the
yes.
school with.
I've heard stories.
He was incredible. I had wanted to meet him because I knew, he knew the healing arts, the Sifu Kujitsu healing arts, and Matosi had tried to pass it on. It didn't get to us through Chow, so we didn't get that part of the art. And for years I couldn't bring myself to call him. And finally, I met somebody, and he told me, he says, "Well, I know Tony Janovich. He's his top student." So he calls Tony, arranges a meeting, and Sig and I got along who doesn't get along with a guy like that? And he gave me his phone number, so I started going over to his place. So every Friday, I'd take him to lunch, and then we would train in his backyard. And so I learned his Danzen Ru system.
Cool.
At the same time. At Janovich's school, they did a six-month program on the Seifu Kujitsu. So I went through all three phases of that and then spent, 10 years refining all of that. Learning from Sig was... pretty amazing. When he was 85 years old, we went to a tournament, and some of the the guys from Hawaii were there in wheelchairs and stuff. Sig entered the self-defense competition and won it.
Wow, I mean, 85 years old.
Once he started moving, I mean, you know, he walked like a guy who was 85, but once he started moving, it was like watching a guy 22, 23 years old. And he had it right up to the end.
Well, you know, thank you for playing the legend's name game and talking about these incredible men of the martial arts. You know, I want to ask you a question, and this is the parts unknown part. You're part of the healing process. I saw that at the event this year at the Hall of Fame. The difference of Kempo, Kaiji Kempo, the styles of Kempo. What would you say to our Kempo brothers who are listening now as far as the healing, all of us together, even though we have different katas and different presentations to bring us together? Will there ever be another Kempo Hall of Fame?
I certainly hope so. I think they're planning one.
Me too. Good. What year are you planning it?
I believe it's going to be next year, 2019. But I will keep you informed.
Yes. And all the Kempo people, as they said, the Kempo or Chinese Kempo or Kaiju Kempo or Kempo around the world, you need to check out. And for more information, you contact Mr. Ted Simmer on Facebook or the number that he gave you. Give me that number again about your book, please.
It's 408-645-4675. Or they can email me if they just want to purchase a book. And I'd be more than happy to sign it. If you want it for yourself, you know, give me your name and a little bit of information about you. I'll personalize it. If you want it as a gift, give me the name of the person you want it for and tell me a little bit about them. I can personalize it and make it as personal as you want. I won't do anything obscene, but...
you know what? I sure appreciate your history tonight and talking about the personal journey that you had along with your martial art journey. It's been so informative. I'm very, very, very pleased. I hope you are too. Now, on information to the Sport Karate Museum Archives, you can go to www.sportkaratemuseumarchives.com and contact us through 713-483-0476. We're also going to be live next weekend. We'll be live Tuesday night at the Super Show in Las Vegas at the Bellagio. So stay tuned for the live show, and we'll be having Ms. Linda Dent and Jim Buettner as our special guests. Thank you again, Ted Simmer, for spending the hour and 15 minutes or hour and 30 minutes with me and sharing your incredible history. And
it's
I hope you still
always a pleasure
work.
Talking with you, Gary, and I was honored to be invited to be on your show.
Are you going to try to come in September?
I am.
Well, great. We'll talk to you when I get back from Vegas, and I'm excited about your Black Belt coming and having to participate in Kata Wars and just having some fun, okay?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Ted, for being on the show. Don't forget, next week we'll be live at the Bellagio in Las Vegas, Nevada, at the Century Martial Arts Super Show on Tuesday night. That's right. Wow! What a great show we've had. Thank you again, Ted Simmer, for being on the show. On behalf of the AMMA Masters Radio Blog Network and my producer, Jesse Bowen, good night. Mahalo and aloha.